Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Tried to run, but I didn't get far. Came to a warm cherry red. Send me off to bed.
John Spencer is a wondrous musician, songwriter, singer, producer, and performer based in New York State. Beloved for his pioneering and influential work in the bands Pussy Galore and the John Spencer Blues Explosion, Spencer has also been a driving force in Boss Hog and Heavy Trash, and has collaborated with everyone from Beck and Beastie Boys to R.L. Burnside and Chuck D, among many, many others. After the Blues Explosion finished touring behind their final album, Freedom Tower, No Wave Dance Party 2015, Spencer took some time off before putting a band together for his debut solo album, 2018's Spencer Sings the Hits. On April 1st, 2022, In the Red Records releases his latest blast of outspoken, noise-infused punk. The record is called Spencer Gets It Lit, and it's credited to John Spencer and the Hitmakers, whose current live incarnation features Janet Weiss and Sam Coombs from Quasi and Bob Burt from Pussy Galore. Ahead of the record's release and extensive touring, John returned to this show to discuss the Hitmakers and the making of Spencer Gets It Lit, collaborating with Sam Coombs and reuniting with Bob Burt to engage with the clanging and banging they once made together in Pussy Galore, why the John Spencer Blues Explosion has definitively broken up, remembering the late Dallas Good of the Sadies and the strange sessions he oversaw to make Andre Williams' Night and Day, making records at Electrical Audio and the Key Club Studio, loving and also encountering James Brown, what's next for Spencer and the Hitmakers, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly staff who will happily help you fill any of your orders, including hard-to-find titles. You can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 675 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented John Spencer, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, John, how's it going?
Well, okay, Vish, how are you?
I'm well, thanks for asking. First of all, where in the world are you?
I'm in Kingston, New York.
Kingston, New York. Whereabouts is Kingston? Is that like upstate or something?
Yeah, it's about 90 miles north of New York City.
Ah, I see. How long have you been in Kingston, if I might ask?
A little less than a year.
Oh, it's a relatively recent move. Well,
yes.
That's interesting. What prompted that?
I think just a lot of different things. It wasn't pandemic related. This was in the works before COVID. I guess it was Christina and I. Christina is my wife. You know, our son was all grown up, and you know, we'd been in New York City for a long time, more than 30 years.
Yeah.
And it sort of seemed like it was time for a new adventure. Yeah. And you know, I think also we're older people, and the way in which we're using New York City and kind of relating to it and the things we're doing had changed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an expensive city. It's a bustling city. I think of you as, God knows, you've mentioned New York City a few times on your records. So I think of you as a hardcore New Yorker. Are you adjusting well to being sort of outside of the city?
Yeah, I mean, I think COVID was probably as terrible as it has been, was probably a good transition or buffer.
Yeah,
the last couple of years or a year and a half, couple of years that we spent in the city were very different due to the pandemic.
Hmm.
And you know, things are getting back to normal, but it's still not totally there.
Yeah,
I mean, for sure, New York City is definitely still looms very large in my head and lives in my heart. And you know, for what it's worth, a lot of these songs on this new record, Spencer Gets It Lit, a chunk of them were written in New York City.
Yeah, well, I will say you're not alone in feeling the need to move from a pretty bustling and expensive city to one that's less so. I've talked to a few people who I associate with New York who have moved elsewhere. I myself have moved from Ontario to Alberta because of the real estate situation and the job situation. And so, I mean, and I feel like some of this angst and tension or whatever you want to call it, I feel like it's reflective on this record, Spencer Gets It Lit in particular. And so I want to get into that. But before we do...
Yeah. I think it's also, those are all valid reasons and you know, points worth discussing. But you know, I think the world has changed a lot since when I first moved to New York City.
Yeah.
The need to be in a centralized place with like-minded people. We can work anywhere, really. You know, anybody, the access to voices and to information is kind of available anywhere you live.
That's true. Although I will say, I was thinking of you, obviously, for this chat and all of our interactions in the past as well. And I don't think of you as like an extremely online guy. Are you enjoying this?
I'm using the internet right now.
Yeah, you're using it right now.
Yeah.
That's true. I'm not saying you're a Luddite, but I also can see you being like, I want to get out into the world and play and tour.
I'm an older person. But I guess I am a bit old fashioned in certain things, but I definitely do use the internet, and especially, you know, I for better or for worse, I manage the band, and you know, I managed all the bands, and I spend a lot of time on the internet doing that busy work.
Yeah. Now, I what I'm frustrated by as we're speaking is that things are opening up, but that part's fine. I'm personally not sure if it's the right time, but whatever. What are you going to do?
That's a very good question, and the whole episode could be about that.
Well, my point though is what I'm frustrated by, and I can hear it on this record in terms of the lyrics. I'm a little frustrated by various things, but in particular in the context of what we were just talking about, this sort of push for normalcy when normal wasn't that great. That's where I'm struggling. Like you mentioned, we can all work anywhere, but I'm starting to feel it now from the people who own real estate. Come back to the office. Come back to the workplace. You know, let's be normal again.
Yeah.
Whereas there's a whole culture of people who are like, I didn't really like normal. This sucks that, you know, some of us have lost people because of this in this pandemic. But
yeah.
I think we learned some great things about how we could function. But that's where I'm frustrated right now. I feel like we're just going to return to making millionaires rich. And
I hope not. I hope not. It would be a real shame if you know, there weren't some lessons learned. And I don't think it is going to be totally the same. I think that I don't know if it's going to be a huge, ginormous paradigm shift. But I do think for a lot of people, it's been a real eye opener.
Yeah,
it's weird to hear about big office complex projects, you know, breaking ground in Manhattan. You know, given that there's so much vacant office space. But you know, people are always going to be trying to make money, and definitely, you know, there has historically been a lot of money to be made in renting office space and owning those buildings.
Yeah,
It's been a long time since I worked in an office. My wife, she is a professional. She works in publishing. Hmm. And, you know, so she has worked the entire time. But it's been okay. But there is definitely something to be lost when you're not all on the same floor and you can't just get up and walk to another desk and speak to somebody in person, you know, or a group of people and hash something out.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I have to use, like, you and I are using a thing right now that everyone has been using in the last couple of years to interact, and in my office work, we use a different thing. But I actually I don't mind it. My wife says the same thing you're saying, by the way. I miss just going over to talk to someone, but I'm like, well, I don't get it because I can do that here. But I don't know. Is it too alien, do you think? Does this feel weird that we're using this?
No, it doesn't feel weird. I just, what I hear from Christina is that you can get into situations where unnecessary problems arise because of the new kind of communication, that it takes a bit longer to resolve something.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, listen, we're not going to resolve office politics today, you and I, John, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think we can do that. But I do want to talk to you about this great record, and I guess I need to begin with the Hitmakers. Those of us who have followed your trajectory know that you play with different people from time to time. Who are the Hitmakers? How did this come to be?
The people, the Hitmakers for this record, Spencer Gets It Lit. It's Bob Burt, my old friend from Pussy Galore, and Bob plays trash. He beat bangs on pieces of scrap metal from the junkyard. Mm-hmm. The straight drummer, trap drummer, is a guy named M. Sword, and this is he was on the first record. Spencer sings the hits, and once again, it's Sam Coombs covering the bass on the synthesizer. And Sam also sings. He sings a lot more on this record,
yeah.
Which I was really psyched about to be able to do that, get Sam to do that, ask him to do it. Then I'm very happy that he did do it. Yeah. And Sam is from he has a band called Quasi. He's played with Elliot Smith. He was in a band called Heat Miser. Mm-hmm. He's an old kind of punk rocker, indie rock guy like me.
I love Quasi. I've seen them a couple of times.
They're just wonderful, and I'm such a big fan. And I'm really, really, really excited because Sword had to take a break from the Hitmakers. So our drummer for the upcoming tour and for the foreseeable future is going to be Janet Weiss, who is Sam's bandmate in Quasi. And Janet is people might know her from Sleater-Kinney. Mm-hmm. She was the drummer for Sleater-Kinney for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So when we start touring next month, this tour that's coming up and for all foreseeable tours in the future, it's going to be Janet on the trap drums, and also Quasi will be playing every show.
Yeah, no, I saw this in the announcement, and I'm very, first of all, I'm envious because I'm no longer in Ontario, and I know you've got at least a Toronto show on the books in Canada. So I'm envious of that.
Where in Alberta are you?
I'm in Edmonton now with my wife's family's from Edmonton. Have you ever been to Edmonton?
Yeah, I think I played there with Heavy Trash and the Sadies.
Oh, yeah, of course you would have. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, so Janet's been on this show. I've seen Sleater-Kinney a few times. And I've seen Quasi, and I've seen you. So I want to see it all congeal. But hopefully someday that'll happen as we contemplate things. I want to go back to Bob for a minute, because that's that's intriguing for those of us who know Pussy Galore and your history with Bob. When's the last time you collaborated with Bob in any sort of fashion before the Hitmakers?
Serious. I think we've played together in like in a benefit show. I think like something for Planned Parenthood a couple years ago. But I mean, serious kind of thing was that last Pussy Galore record, the history of the music of the rock, which was recorded in 89 or 90.
Yeah, so it's been a long time. You guys have obviously remained connected as friends.
Yeah, we're friends, and I've been a fan of the different bands that Bob's been playing with and watched him play, and with these various groups, people like the Chrome Cranks and Knoxville Girls, and now Lydia Lunch Retrovirus. So I made the first record, Spencer Sings the Hits. I think that was recorded in 2017, came out in 2018, my memory serves. And that record was just a trio. It was me and Sam Coombs and Emma Sword. We met in Benton Harbor, Michigan, and made that record. And I played all the percussion stuff. I overdubbed all the banging and the clanging. And when it came time to hit the road, I wanted to turn it into a real thing and get out and play some shows. I turned to Bob Burt and asked him if he would join us and to do the blunt banging and the clanging. So Bob has been part of the Hitmakers since 2018.
Let me ask you that. Okay, I see that. I appreciate that's great. I mean, that's excellent for various reasons. Why the banging and the clanging? Why do you think that's an essential part of this particular band?
I dig it. You know, it's just reveling in noise and I think. When I made the first record, it was, Blues Explosion was over. I didn't have a band. I wasn't really working with Matt Verderay and Heavy Trash anymore. Boss Hog, we put out a record and toured, and, so we were kind of going into an inactive period. And so I very much missed having a band, and the Blues Explosion kind of ended quite abruptly. And, so I was realized I was just kind of in mourning and pining, for running a band and missing, playing and especially playing live. So I thought, well, I'm just going to try to get something started. So I wrote an album's worth of songs and reached out to Sam and Sword and arranged this recording session. And in my head, I guess the idea or the MO was to do something down and dirty, a little bit more like old Pussy Galore, like when I started way back in 85. And part of that was a lot of feedbacking guitars and trebly guitars, and part of that was the metal percussion. There were other things, other nods to Pussy Galore in that first record.
We did
a lot of stuff with there are a lot of about half the songs on that record are recorded with a slacked tuning on the guitar, and that is a nod to in the early days of Pussy Galore. None of us had a guitar tuner, and so the first couple Pussy Galore records or EPs, well, we just tuned to each other. So there's these really weird slack tunings we're playing the songs, and so making the first record that was we'd every song we'd record the song straight as it was written, and then I would retune I had these couple different Pussy Galore tunings. There was one really slack one and one kind of medium slack, and then we tried every song in both of those tunings. Sam would also would have to transpose what he was playing on the synthesizer to match my slack tuning. We try it out. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it would sound cool, sometimes it didn't. It was a kind of trial and error thing. Bill Skibbe, the engineer and co-producer, would say, yeah, maybe that medium one sounds good. And so then we'd work on that. So I spoke, it was, the metal percussion was part of a thing, trying to, I guess I was reaching back into an old bag of tricks, and I guess you could say embracing my history a little bit.
Yeah, we get a little reflective, I think, as we get older and start to, whether subconsciously or consciously, sometimes we do end up revisiting our past in some ways. It sounds like that's occurred a little bit for you, whether it doesn't sound like it was conscious, it was just the circumstances. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it was. No, it was really. It was like I said, or I was trying to explain. It was a plan in my head. I had the sound in my head for that first album. Very thin guitars, layers of trebled, super trebly guitars, a lot of feedback, fuzz guitar, the synth bass, and the metal percussion. That stuff was in my head. I could hear.
It sounds amazing, and thanks. I mean your work with Bill Skibbe is it's really yielding some fantastic work. He's a constant collaborator of yours, it seems, these days.
It's been, I think, the Spencer Gets It Lit is the fourth record I've made with him. I did the Blues Explosion record Meat and Bone, which was recorded at Key Club. The name of Bill and it's Bill Skibbe and Jessica Ruffins. They own and operate the Key Club Recording Company in Benton Harbor, Michigan. So I've done a track. Meat and Bone, the Blues Explosion album, with them. Then we did the Boss Hog album, Broodex, and all out there. And now I've done two Hitmakers records with the B Club. I probably met Bill in '99 when the Blues Explosion did the basic tracks for the Acme album at Electrical Audio, which is Albini's studio in Chicago.
Yeah.
And at the time, Bill Skibbe was working for Albini. And I think he was one of the persons that helped build Electrical.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Blues Explosion went out to play New Year's at the Cavalry Metro in Chicago. We did two shows, I think, and then stayed on for 3 or 4 days at Electrical. And we recorded this big batch of songs we've been working on. And so Bill Skibbe, he says he was around then. So I probably met him back then, but I don't remember that. But I do remember meeting him the first time I ever went to the Key Club, which was probably in 2005 or 2007. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I was passing through there I was on tour with Heavy Trash. And at the time, the Heavy Trash band was the Sadies.
Right.
Dallas, we had a couple of days off in Dallas, both the Sadies and Heavy Trash, me and Matt and the Sadies. We all had a connection to Andre Williams. We all had worked with Andre at one time or another. The Sadies had backed up Andre. Andre had toured with the Blues Explosion as a support act, and Matt Verrey had recorded and produced a record for Andre, one of the ones for Norton Records, the Norton label. So we all had this in common. And so those tours with the Sadies, pretty much the entire, all those tours, running throughout were, people in, from this, anyone was just quoting Andre. It was constant in the band. Just these kind of Andre-isms, everybody. So everybody had an Andre story. Everybody had like some strange turn of phrase, and it was just nonstop Andre. And so we were on tour, and we had a couple of days off in Dallas. It was Dallas's idea and this is very sad. No, it's not sad, but I mean, it's, I'm just now thinking, feeling sad because we, Dallas is gone.
I think, you know, I think, you know, I knew Dallas rather well, and,
I know, yeah,
it's been very hard. I've been checking in with some people, and some Sadies and other band, Don Pyle, and I'll, Don Pyle from Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet, and I have been texting rather constantly about stuff, and we're all sharing photos and videos, and it's, I don't, it's weird. We're all just sort of doing it. No one's really talked about it, but I try to share. I'm just going through my archives because I've been watching Dallas play music since I was a kid. In his band, the Satanatras, and then the Sadies. I got to see one of their earliest shows, and I didn't even know that was the case. So we're all just compulsively trying to keep him around, I think. I don't really... Yeah. This kind of mourning is strange because we knew each other, and we exchange messages all the time, but I feel sometimes like, are people my friends? Am I friends? Are we colleagues? What is it? I don't know. But when we hang out, it's always great. You know how it is, I think, John? You travel, and you meet people, and you're friends, but you don't see them all the time, and you don't talk to them all the time until maybe you get to town, and you play a show or whatever. So I'm... Yeah. I wrestle with that feeling so remote, but... all this to say, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I can. No, I just wanted to say I was going to ask you how you're doing with this, you know, as best we can, and or you know, whatever that's worth. And it sounds like it's got to you.
Yeah. It was. Sometimes it sneaks up on me. It was very. Incredibly sad.
It's the worst. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm curious who you've been in touch with and if you have any news, but maybe I should ask you that.
I can talk to you about any news you might want to know after we're done, suppose. I'm trying to... we're sharing things. It's very public. A public person's going, but I am trying to respect everyone's privacy as much as I can at the same time. But we are, as I wrote in something and as I've expressed to people, like... it's interesting, John. Like, I first fell in love with you and your music when I was a kid. I first saw the Blues Explosion in, at the Phoenix in Toronto in 1995, I want to say. And so I was all in on the Blues Explosion from that moment on. And there's no way I would have known at that point that at some point, you know, that the Sadies and you with your work together and Heavy Trash and other things, I wouldn't have known that you'd be connected in any way at that point. But then as I got to know Dallas was this linchpin for so many of us. Like, I'm sure you feel connected to people because of Dallas. I think Dallas was a quiet, stoic social convener. I mean, he was really funny and goofy and lively, but it dawned on me as I was pondering the loss that, like, I know so many people and have had so many wild experiences in my life that are all basically connected to Dallas. So I'm feeling... And it's just one of those things you take for granted, I guess, like just all the connections I've had. I told a story recently, like I got on the phone with Jim Jarmusch about a year ago about some project I was working on. It was a Neil Young thing. And so we thought we'd get a hold of Jim, and I got on the phone with him. I said, "Hey, Jim, I'm Vish. I'm from Canada." He's like, "Oh, I know who you are." He's like, you're the guy who interviewed the Sadies on your talk show. I'm like, "Yeah." I was a little embarrassed about that. It was a bit, I thought, awkward, but I have heard that people thought it was very funny because they weren't really playing. It's with some of the questions, and some of my questions weren't great. I was having an off night. Then I rewatched it because he said it was so fun, and he said it was his favorite thing on YouTube. So I put it back up. I'm like, yeah, it's good. They're good. It was good. But my reputation with Jim Jarmusch, of all people, preceded me because of Dallas and the Sadies. So I'm... That's just an example. Like, I just didn't even think of it, you know? Like, oh, people know me and I know them because of the Sadies. Like, that's pretty remarkable, I would say. Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to go on there. I'm sure you have similar connections.
Dallas was he was. That is one. It was definitely one of the very nice things about him, that he was so passionate about music and art, and that he really, you're right. He really did, you know, kind of work tirelessly, although I would doubt he considered it work, to put things together, to come up with these connections and combinations of creative people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how many times did I see Heavy Trash, and you guys came down to do the live album with them as well, and yeah, anyway, yeah, it's just endlessly hard. Sorry, you were going to tell the story about, by the way, I also met Bill at Electrical Audio. That's where I met Bill.
Oh.
So that's,
what were you doing
that's
there?
Just I was accompanying the band Fucked Up. We're recording at Electrical, and
yeah.
Bill was running
about those Fucked Up sessions.
I'm sure you did. Yeah. I'm sure you did. Yeah. And it was nice to meet him.
Were you just hanging out, or were you there to do a story?
We did some media stuff. We filmed a little doc on it ended up running. No, it wasn't for Vice. It was for a company here in Canada at the time. And my friend, my colleague Colin Medley, and I filmed a little thing. And Steve and I did a relatively popular segment about him making me a cup of Kopi Luwak coffee. I don't know if you've ever had that. It's the rat poop coffee, or the civet cat. The civet cats eat the coffee beans.
Yeah, I've heard about that from Bill.
Yeah, he wanted to make me a fancy coffee. So yeah. We filmed that. And yeah, but yeah, I ultimately was just hanging out. I thought it would be fun.
So
but we did end up...
You've been there. You know what the place is like then. You know what Benton Harbor's like. And
oh, no. Sorry. This was at Electrical.
Oh, shoot.
I haven't been to the Key Club. No. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I know they did sessions there as well. They did basic tracks at Electrical.
So that must have been a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah, like 2013, I want to say.
Oh, maybe, wow.
Or something
okay.
like that.
All right.
Yeah.
So, Benton Harbor's an interesting place. But, well, again, so we're on tour with Heavy Trash in the 80s. We all have Andre Williamson home. And I don't know. It was Dallas' idea, and he set about making this plan because we had a couple of days off. We're somewhere near Benton Harbor. It's like, let's go to this the Key Club. It's an amazing studio. Let's get Andre, who was in Chicago at the time, and let's record some stuff. And I don't know if Dallas had been working on this for a long time. My memory of it is just that he started talking about it once we were on the road in the van on tour. So that's what we did. We camped out at the Key Club. You can stay there. And
yeah,
at least two nights, I think we were there. I don't know, two or three nights, and spent a couple of days recording with Andre. But Andre was in terrible, terrible shape. He was very sick. He had flu or pneumonia or something. He'd just gotten out of jail recently. He was just in terrible shape. And there were, I guess the Sadies had some songs, or I think some things were just sort of off the cuff and put together, you know, in the studio. And Matt had a song or two, or definitely contributed to stuff. And so there was a lot of music got recorded, but it was very hard to get Andre to do anything. And when he would do vocals, it was almost impossible to do them live with the band. And overdubbing was very difficult. It was a bit of a train wreck. And Kelly Hogan was there, the singer. She tours with Nico. She works with Nico Case. Sally Timms came as well.
From the Mekons?
What's that?
From the Mekons?
Yeah.
Just contextualizing things for anyone listening.
Sorry. So Sally and Kelly came in from Chicago, I think. I called up Danny Krohoff from Detroit. Dan, of course, is from the Demolition Doll Rods and the Gorries. And Dan with Mick Collins made that the kind of one of the first, you know, Andre Williams return records, the amazing Silky album that was on In the Red. There are a lot of people who loved Andre, a lot of really cool people and good musicians, but its sessions were not easy because Andre was sick. And it also didn't help the matters that there was a young couple there who were making a documentary about Andre. And I think the film came out. You might be able to find it on YouTube. And it just was a bad scene. And the record finally came out. I think the title was Night and Day, and it's on Yip Rock, the Yip Rock label, I believe. And it didn't come out till years later. And I think it was, and really Dallas pulled a rabbit out of the hat. You know, he spent a long time, my understanding is he spent a long time on subsequent dates trying to get Andre to record some vocals and piecing together usable vocal takes from what was there. But there's some really good stuff on that record, but it's just it was you know, was Andre was in really bad shape. It was bad.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the first time I ever worked at the Key Club, and I fell in love with the place. And so when next time I was going to make it up, I said, well, I know a place to go.
Yeah, well, like I say, I think it's been a fruitful collaboration. All the records you've made with Bill have sounded great, this one included. You said something that I can't let pass, because I will tell you that I've been on a pretty wild blues explosion kick of late. Just I was missing some records. By kick, I mean I was missing a few records, so I thought I'd start collecting them, and they're showing up, and the discography is almost... complete, but you said the band ended abruptly. Is that common knowledge? I did not hear of this. Is it done?
I mean, I thought people knew.
I might have missed it.
Didn't really want to make a big announcement about it, I guess, because in case something changed, you know, what's the point of saying never again?
Yeah.
The last record was Freedom Tower, and that was 2015, I believe.
Yeah, it was.
We were touring after that and playing all over, touring around the world, and then Judah Bauer got really sick. He's developed a respiratory ailment.
Oh, no.
And so it was very, very hard, and it became impossible for him to travel, and also to, you know, being in a venue, and, you know, just couldn't, yeah, he, we had to stop.
Oh, God, I didn't know that. I'm so sorry to hear that. That's very sad for me.
He's okay. Yeah. He's all right. He's much better. He's fine. I just, you know, we had a good long run.
Well, it's one of the most fantastic bands I've ever seen, and I can only imagine that since the pandemic began, he must be a little bit on edge with the kind of ailment he has. You're saying he's doing okay, though?
Yeah, yes. Okay. Yeah, he's all right.
So it's not hard feelings or anything. It's definitely a health. Okay.
No, somebody couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
So that was the end. Yeah.
That's very sad for me to hear, because as you may recall,
it was sad for me. Yeah. Well, like I said, yeah. I was kind of in a depressed and in a funk for a couple of years. Yeah.
I don't know if you remember, but with the last time you did a swing through Ontario, or one of the last times, I would think, I saw you guys in Hamilton and London. And we did some interviews and stuff like that, and I was just so impressed.
Yeah, I think we're sitting out in a parking lot or something, and somebody was grilling sausages.
That's right, in Hamilton. There was like a roller derby or some roller derby people had organized some sort of benefit hot dog stand or something, and Russell seemed particularly interested in the roller derby people, if I may say, and getting some hot dogs. So
it's your show. So
how's Russell doing, by the way?
He's doing okay, thanks. He lives in Indianapolis. He has a band with his wife, and the band is called Service.
Oh, okay, cool.
But it's spelled like an acronym. I don't know what it stands for, but it's, you know, it's all caps with dots.
Yeah. So, by the way, I should say, by the way, all of us were quite intrigued by the roller derby people. They were roller derby people in the middle of the night, it felt like, and selling hot dogs. So I wasn't trying to insinuate anything. I'm just saying he was intrigued. Anyway, it's good. So he's doing well and he's playing in a band.
Russell and Jill have a band called Service. Jill used to have a band called We Are Hex.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, sorry, and I don't mean to belabor this. I appreciate that the Blues Explosion is really an immersive live band. Given Judah's condition there, could you potentially record, or would you not feel like that has a point to it, given what you are noticing?
I suppose so. I don't know what the... Maybe one day.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I will tell you.
I think Judah is such a wonderful musician.
Yeah.
He's such an amazing guitar player. I think he could excel as a studio musician. I just don't think that's where he's just not interested.
Yeah, fair.
You know, I think he'd be a great session player. I think he'd be a great producer. I know that he's had people ask him, and he's just... Yeah, Judah's just not interested.
I was really excited to get to have... What happened in that London show that I was referring to is I spoke to each of you individually. For the podcast I ended up making. And also Cattle were at that show. I don't know if you remember that.
Cattle.
So I talked to a bunch of people, but I actually got to talk to Judah and Russell individually, which I'd never done in my life. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed speaking with Judah. I've long admired him. And all I was going to get at, though, is on this record, hearing Sam sing the way he sings, I couldn't help but think of Judah. Do you know where I'm coming from there? Just his attack, his sort of speak singing, some of the screaming.
Yeah, that kind of laid back and the high, lonesome voice. Yeah, I guess.
I was like, oh, this feels Blues Explosion-y in that regard. But, I mean, from your perspective, beyond the people involved, I'm just curious, how would you characterize the distinction between the Hitmakers and the Blues Explosion?
One of the huge things is that the Hitmakers are writing by myself. I write the songs, and then the first album, I showed Sam and Sword every song, you know, what we just worked through them. The second with the second album, Dispenser Gets It Lit, I shared demos with Bob and Sam and Sword. So that was a difference there between the first and second album. But both albums are writing everything by myself. With Blues Explosion, we always wrote together.
Yeah.
I think there may have been one or two early songs where I kind of brought them into the practice space fully formed or almost completely formed. But the Blues Explosion was very much a collaborative effort, and writing was something we did through, you know, through playing, through action.
Right. So now when Sam is singing, and sort of you have this interplay where you're kind of riffing off each other the way sometimes you and Judah would. Does Sam write his parts there? Are you improvising?
It was before making this record. That was definitely in my head. It was a plan of mine. I really wanted to have Sam singing and Sam's vocals on a lot of songs. In the 2 years since the first record and the touring we'd done, Sam, you know, on the album's tracks, the songs, when we play them live, he would pick up, you know, things where I, like on the album, in the studio version, where I had double tracked my vocal or laid down like a complimentary vocal or something. So Sam was already doing that stuff on the first record tracks live. And one of my favorite things is when we began, as we played more and more shows, we began to work out more and more songs. And so we played, we played a few of Sam's songs. So that was a lot great for me to have a little break in the set and probably great for the audience too. So I, with this second record in thinking about it and dreaming about it, I really wanted to feature Sam on the mic, but no, I wrote the parts for Sam.
Okay.
It became clear. And then in the studio where, you know, some songs there was a little bit of room, you know, as far as like, you know, it's not, everything's not entirely finished and buttoned up as far as the composition and the lyrics and stuff. And Sam was also, you know, he was just there for a week. So once we did all the basic tracks, then the priority was to get Sam to do any and all overdubs that he was going to do before he had to go back home to Oregon.
Yeah.
And because there are a lot of songs on this album where there's an interplay between the two vocals, we spent a lot of time where, we'd both be recording our vocals at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so in doing that, there were times where, you know, I'd egg Sam on, say like, yeah, just try something out. And Sam would always kind of stop and say like, yeah, I'm not like that. I'm not, you know. So I something I learned about Sam is, and it was great that he could say, yep, I'm not that kind of person, that he's not an ad libber or something.
I see. Okay. I didn't think it was improvised in that regard, but there's sometimes an off the cuff aspect. Having seen you perform live too, I mean, it feels like you're not ad-libbing per se, but sometimes, yeah, they're just sort of exclamation points, if you will, you know. But when I dial into the lyrics, this record feels particularly of its time. I feel like you are talking to people and talking about things like education, information, you know, biology. Have faith in biology. You know, some of us have been myself included, kind of cowering in fear of the world during this pandemic. And also we are encountering people whose worldviews are not based in science and math and things like that. Mm-hmm. So this, am I right to suggest this is skewing towards social commentary from you in this regard?
Yeah.
So what is your take on your, this isn't also, we've also learned this isn't an American phenomenon. We, some of us tend to pile up on America as being, you know, whatever. But do you feel like this is a particularly American issue right now?
Sadly, I think you're right. It's not exclusive to the United States of America.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's, I am American and that this is where I live. And so, you know, it's in my face.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah. There are songs where I can't, like, I think of you as a great storyteller as much as you are very, like, you're an entertaining guy. And you write really catchy songs. You know, how many of us have just yelled the things you've said to ourselves? You know, I actually stumbled upon a video of me and my son when he was still in his high chair, and I just got on a riff. I guess my wife filmed it. I was just like, "You got the flavor," and he was like, "You got the flavor." Like he was just learning to talk, so I was trying to give him basic stuff. Anyway, you've said so many things that are in my head and a lot of our heads. So yeah, I think of you as this great songwriter, and you're very expressive. I was thinking about the song "The Worst Facts," which I feel like starts out as kind of a story about something you experienced maybe at CBGB's, and then it gets into what I was talking about earlier, the kind of like, you know, the misinformation that we're all dealing with right now. What's going on in that song? Can you speak to am I right? Is it sort of two things going on at the same time?
It is two things, yeah. I had written two sets of lyrics for that song and then just figured, what the hell? Let's do James Brown and do part one and part two, and you know, and just let the brother rap. You know, I had a lot of stuff I wanted to say. So yeah, it starts off about it starts off as a diss track, sort of, you know, talking about some terrible bands, and then it segues into a more pointed commentary about today's hellscape.
Yeah, and then there's songs like Wormtown seem reflective of your childhood, maybe, or something. I don't know if you're singing in the first person there or adopting a character, but
for sure, yeah. Some of those lines, a few of those lines are directly lifted from my personal history.
So yeah, that kind of speaks to our what I was saying earlier about maybe you feeling a bit more reflective these days. I know you were saying you were very conscious about maybe returning to your noisier roots, but even in singing about, like I say, if what I'm hearing is true, like just my mom made the best rhubarb pie. Like, that's just a sweet sentiment. And I don't know if that's coming from you personally. It sounds like it is.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. there are allusions on, like, get up and do it to pop culture and dances and an old time kind of feel. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I feel like there's some reflection going on. I am a huge James Brown fan, but I only got to see him once. The last time I saw the Blues Explosion, and I'd seen the Blues Explosion many times before that, but something about those shows clicked. It was like a review. It reminded me of a James Brown show. Did you get to see him a lot? I know you're. I think you're a fan.
Not a lot. A few times. I saw a few times, but I think it was the first time was in the early '80s, and at that time I can't remember, or I just wasn't aware enough to like who was playing with him. I don't know if I ever got to see him with any of the great musicians that he had in his bands at various times. It was already kind of late in the day there.
But he's resonated with you, and
for sure. We even got to play, and even got to play with him.
Oh, wow.
Big outdoor festival in Japan. And we were scheduled to headline over James Brown. Wow. And got there, we're like, are you guys crazy? Like, what the heck? It's James Brown. And this was when Blues Explosion was probably the height of our popularity in Japan, and so it's a big outdoor festival, and they said no, you got, you know, you're the headliners, and so we're just like, this is wrong. This is so wrong. But so we're watching James Brown's show from the wings, and he went way over time, way, way too long.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he was pissed off at the situation, but we worshiped James Brown. So.
Did you get to interact with him at all?
I stood in line to say hello.
Yeah.
Okay. And so did get to say hello and shake his hand. You know, there were a couple other things that happened on that day.
Yeah.
Some very funny things, but I don't think it's appropriate to talk about.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. I appreciate that. Well, I love this record and I want to congratulate you on it. And I want to thank you for making more music and speaking out a little bit here as well. If people want to learn more about you and this record and the tour dates and all that stuff, because there's a lot of stuff coming up, where would you like to send them on the telephones and the computers there, John?
Oh, shoot.
It's
just one of the big difference from having a band, you know, now compared to when I was like in the 80s.
Yeah, I noticed you started
so much time spent with this, like, you know, networking and social media and all this stuff.
It's just frustrating. I know. I think you started, I believe I followed it. You started a new Twitter handle for this project, right? Or I don't know if it's new, but
no, it's been going for it since the first record.
Yeah.
So they're on the Instagram for the, it's called John Spencer Hitmaker.
Mm-hmm.
If you go there, that's a good place to start because there is a link tree which puts you in touch with all sorts of stuff.
I got one of those too. Okay, so I'll link to all this stuff for the podcast people. I just wanted to.
Thank you.
It's on. It's out on In the Red again, right? Or
that is correct. Yeah, the great In the Red label from California.
Awesome. All right. Well, listen, if we can go out on a song from this record, could you please pick a song for us and tell us why you chose it?
Oh, play Junk Man. It's the first song on the record, and it's a good. It's a good punk song. Got some real spirit in there.
You are, I didn't get a chance to ask about it because I forgot, but it was on my mind. You have some thoughts about our new, it seems like a different kind of fixation on the billionaire class. They're in the news all the time, these billionaires. I feel like some of them may show up in this song. Is that fair?
Yes, it's fair.
And yeah. you call out some of them by name. You're a New Yorker. You were around when Trump was more of a joke than a serious threat to all of humankind. What do you have any take? What's with the billionaire news cycle? I don't understand why we're talking.
I don't get it either. It's just, you know, I just, the moral compass is just so off. I don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, again, I think
I don't, the worship of, you know, wealth and, you know, it's just, I want to swear, but I know.
You can. It's a podcast. You can do whatever you want. You can swear if you want.
Oh, really?
To. Yeah, okay. Yeah. No, I'm with you on it, and I think as people, I took some. I don't know if solace is the right word, but when I listened to your record and heard some of your thoughts about such things, I'm like, yeah, God damn it! I'm glad someone's saying something about this. It's very frustrating to live in this time and have children and all that stuff. It's very weird. So I will say it gave me a little sense of release as I got through, as I spend time with your record and listen to the songs.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. And I mean, some of these, these themes that are also there, some of them in the first record, the first Hitmaker's record.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of songs and that kind of grappling with authenticity.
Yeah. Well, let's go to this now. This is an excellent and actually the first song on the new Spencer Gets It Lit record by John Spencer and the Hitmakers. This is Junkman.
Yes.
John Spencer, always a pleasure to speak with you and an honor for me personally. Thank you so much for your time and best luck in the future.
Thank you, Vish.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Get down there. but you're pushing it. Hey, you're just a gentleman.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It always means so much to me to have John Spencer on this show. He's been on this show, I think, 3 times, and we've had many other encounters and interviews and conversations in the past. So, hey, it just means a lot. What can I say? Thank you so much, John, for appearing on this, the 675th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it on your favorite podcast player, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook. You can follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna. Also, please consider visiting patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this otherwise free podcast going. If you're listening to this on your favorite player, you probably hopefully haven't paid anything for that, and I haven't been paid by them to make the show. But one way I can get paid directly a little bit for my work here, Patreon. And $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content from my archives and also some bonus content from current interviews. And it's flexible, by the way. You can start at $6, and if you're like, these bonus things aren't very good at all, I'm going to go down to $5 a month. That's fine. You can do whatever you want. It's flexible. And you can always change it. You can go up, you can go down. And people do all sorts of things. So please consider doing that at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Oh, and if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and order stuff from their website there, blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show here. And you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with John Spencer. Again, he's been on the show before, so if you like John, dig through the archives and find those episodes. And check out his new Hitmakers record. It's great. Spencer gets it lit. I really enjoy it. And if you like, subscribe to this podcast, follow this podcast, tell your friends about the show, spread the word about the show if you enjoy what you heard today or if you enjoy what you hear regularly. And otherwise, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.